So I'd like to start by just congratulating Robert. Robert's, of course, a senior Australia with an international reputation as well. But it's great that he and colleagues like him, his stature, are entering the Sculpture Prize. It's certainly not inevitable that they'll win. It's not even inevitable in the Woollahra Sculpture Prize that they'll get included in such a huge range to choose from. But it is fabulous to see that the prize now is attracting one way here, Robert Owen, a whole range of very, very senior artists on the Australian scene. So, and it's a terrific outcome and a very worthy prize. So with that introduction, Rob, would you like to take us through your
work? Of course. I've been making these for some time. They do begin with a conceptual idea or an idea of time and process, and come from a very, very basic dodecahedron in terms of geometries. It's called a dodecahedron. So what I do with this is take those 20 nodes and 30 edges. I have a piece of paper that size, and it's got a grid on it, and then I have some little plasticine, 20 plasticine balls, roll up, and I throw them in the air, and they land on the grid. So you can imagine that one would land there, one would land there, one would land there, or there, or there. And then I join the lines together, three to each node, make a drawing of that. Then I begin to try and reconstruct that drawing, the twist of upsticks and hot glue gun, and see if I can pull that drawing into space. So if you imagine that a line like that could be 9 inches, if you like, but it could be in perspective, and therefore it might be 24 inches. If you're looking down the line, going down there, you'd see it projected onto a flat plane. So I try to reverse that thing of bringing this into space. And what happens with it, it goes into knots. It's a kind of knot theory, which is more or less representative of present-day geometries, if you like, through computers and mathematics. But what intrigues me is that is the idea of taking space, which is an old traditional thing of working with three-dimensional forms, moving around it in a spatial thing, the idea of space as the subject itself. So it's like a drawing in space about space. So it's pretty abstract and pretty difficult. The reference that references back to Greece, symmetria, symmetria is an old Greek word, and I forget the sculptor of that period, and my memory's going these days. But there is a human figure called Symmetria. Can't think of the sculptor's name now, but it was about using that proportions and the mathematics of the gesture of the harmonics discords to have those figures become so that they work in harmony. So there's kind of invisible harmony that goes on in the world, and we're all connected to a vibration of everything. So I'm interested in this very subtle quality of will this work? Can you bring this into harmony, which was once a harmonic form, and now it's changed because of a present-day condition? And can one still produce something that has a sort of harmonic, pleasing aesthetic to it, that's constantly intriguing and ongoing? So that's the basis of it. 2 years ago, a physicist from Canberra University contacted me. He saw some work in the city here, and he wanted to know what I was doing and how did I do these things, because this is what he was making. But from mathematics, physicists, because they're remaking things, you know, it's like nature, in the sense they're changing nature and remaking new materials. And he works with atoms and molecules and things. Chemistry and things, health and so on. So he came to the studio and he was a bit blown away with showing me how to make these things intuitively with the plasticine bits and the hot glue gun and the system upstairs. So we became very good friends now. He always brings a bottle of red wine to the studio. We spent hours talking about it. He explains to me what I'm doing and I don't understand it. And I show him again how I do it. So he's actually just written a very interesting paper on the work for the Science Magazine. Or Science Magazine, the main thing. This coming together of art and science. There's a point in which there's a kind of... So a lot of these kinds of forms that tend to be appearing now, but from what he's reading, is a lot of the things that you see under the microscope. You start to see nature has produced a lot of these things, or has a way of producing them through this thing. So in a sense, artists are really directly connected to nature.
We're
actually connected to it. In fact, I saw an article, which I didn't read, but I saw it, and I was interested in it at the beginning of the year, an exhibition I was in called Mind Shadows. And it's a term used by other departments of science. And the description of it is that mind shadows are the things that we all connect into as artists. And they say that artists are connected to this mind shadow, which is directly connected to the whole of nature, and we're the evolutionary process of nature. This isn't a note to that. Can't wait to get home and read this article. I'll send you a copy of it.
I know it was originally hot glue and
just about
why has it become so robust now?
Then I sort of thought, I think if this one's looking good, this one, I then go to a next stage and it's just a piece of welding rod tacked, run together and welding rod, so it's a bit more stable than hot glue, because in summertime it'll start to collapse and melt a bit. And then I'd make some adjustments in terms of the ratio between it might be. So with Cisco Barb's sticks, it's roughly 12 inches long. I've got no official numbers.
Yep.
And so I think, well, I have to have some kind of part of that brain to do this intuitive thing with.
Yep.
And so I divide that up into, 2, 4, 6, 8, or 3, 12. So I've got a series of little sticks that all fit into the Cisco Barb's length, but I'll be joining links and things in terms of making the models. So I have to point those find the spaces that they go to within that limitation. Things like this one, where you've got fixed forms in a way, but you've also got that intuitive play with them.
Yeah. And what's the significance of the H kind?
It's one of those experiences I had many years ago. I went to a Greek island for a weekend and stayed 3 years. But in 64, I won a Italian scholarship, and there was no money attached to it, but when I got to Rome, they gave me a pile of bits of paper, and there were certificates to get food every day, to get hotels in every town, to see every museum from the north to the south of Italy. It was a fantastic experience, because in those days, the word tourism didn't exist, you were just travellers. And so there were pensioners that you could go to. So I travelled the whole length of Italy. When I got to Venice, I went across to Padua. It's a very famous small church there that has the Giotto's chapel. It's a chapel that Giotto painted. And the whole interior is painted with ultramarine blue, which was made from lapis lazuli. But it's an extraordinary experience, that experience. And I think for me, those experiences changed my life anyway at certain points, and that shifted to other things I was doing. What I was doing before that made me rethink it, and I think I have to relearn it. So I went back to this Greek island and sat there for another 2 years trying to figure out what I was going to do rather than do the things that I learned at school to do. So I always use that. I've used that for many years now. Many years ago, I was using installation, doing a lot of installation. And that came from that experience. Strangely enough, when I moved on those days to London and saw Ed's Klein, I thought, it was like, what? I can't use this anymore. So I didn't.
That's not Ed Klein.
And so I'll have to tell you the difference between the two blues. There's about six blues in the ultramarine blue pigment making. And the lower end, number three, is Ed's Klein blue. It's closer to the yellow end of the spectrum. I use the 6 blue, which is closer, you see a bit more red in it, it's closer to the red end of the spectrum. That's a blue they use in the dyeing industry, because there's so much colour washed out from your dyeing clothes, particularly in India and other places they dye in clothes, that blue, a lot of it's washed out, so they use this very high intense end of the spectrum for it. And the middle end, 4 and 5, is used for the artist pigment, because it doesn't go as black. And if you mix that with a medium, beanie that closes off the light from the pigments to reflect this particular colour. So it's very difficult then in gloss finishes because you have to make it. It's not ultramarine blue, it's very, very dark in a gloss finish. It's not really good.
Well, there's a bit of technical insight into the six versions of ultramarine blue. Other questions of
The shadow aspect.
Well, the shadow is very important in life, and we all know about the shadow, so it has a symbolic representation to everything. It's something we just take for granted because we all have a shadow, whether it be a psychological one through Jung or somebody, or whether it's in nature, sun itself or light itself produces this shadow. So I see that as part of the work. There's a kind of reflection in it, and it takes you back to its origins, you know, a piece of paper on the table and throw the things down and those points are there and come to the space. But it now goes back into space in different ways. If it's in the sunlight, if it's on the walls, as the sun moves around, it changes and shifts.
And the idea of movement, you know, that this is a set of photography and it must be the light to be just photographing here.
Yes, yes. It doesn't go so much in my studio because I've got daylight in the studio and it's filtered through a bit. So when you put it on the wall, there's very little shadows on it, but I do have a spotlight as well, just a superpower equipment. Because they then tell you something else about another form you can make from it.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Rod. Great insight.